The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 27th of May, 2020. I'm in Edithburg, here with Arthur Parker. Arthur, thank you very much for participating in this oral history program, The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. Can I please just get you to start things off by just to state your full name, your date of birth, and your service number?
My full name is Arthur Ernest Parker, 7 of the 1st, 1926. My service number is PLYX 11 28 23 C. We come from Harrogate in Yorkshire, in a small village known as Bachelor Gardens or Bilton, and a farming stock. I went to a church school.
Do you have many memories of your primary school days?
A few. One of the memories I remember the headmaster. It was a three-teacher school, church school. I think there were only about 30 pupils. I'm not right sure, but I think. I can't say that I enjoyed my school days because I was working. Most of the time, in that particular era where I was born and when I was brought up, that is between the two wars, I had a job to do as soon as I woke in the morning, was to go collect eggs. Even when I was, I was just going to school when I had to go collect eggs. And I had a habit of eating them as well, but raw. Matter of fact, in interest, my breakfast was raw eggs and pork or bacon. They killed our own. They killed your own thing, and black pudding and all that sort of thing. They didn't waste it. The only thing that was wasted at all was the whistle of the pig. Nothing else. And then I'd go to school. School finished at 3 o'clock, and I went down to whichever field or paddock the cows were in. We had 20. Walked behind them and make sure that they got to the milking mistle, as we called it. And we had three mistles. Mainly the cows were in stalls. Summertime they were free, but wintertime they were fed and bedded down in wintertime in cover, undercover, because the winters were pretty, well, you wouldn't get any milk. And part of my job, as soon as I was able, was to deliver milk locally with an uncle. My uncle drove the pony and milk float. I carried a can and dished it out with a half measure to the basin on the doorstep, and then they sent the bill round once a week, sort of thing. As a matter of fact, give you an interest out of the children in those days, I can't remember a lot. It was normal. Every 3 weeks or 4 weeks, whatever it was, it depends on The blacksmith's shop was between me, between where we lived in Bachelor Gardens, and the Christchurch School, which was about a couple of miles away, 3 miles, something like that. And I used to have to go to Ingram's and get his horse. Then Charles Henry and John Kay, they put their horse, and I'd walk those horses to the blacksmith and leave them there. And then after school at Christchurch, I'd go pick them up and walk them back. There was a rule, no riding. This was my uncle's and that. Uncle Charles was like a surrogate father to me. Because, as I say, my dad was more or less occupied with the army and other things. And no riding, but I used to. I used to get near his wall, pull, particularly one of them, it was quite, well, come on. And he'd come upside the wall and up on it, ride back. And they all used to, and I passed the school where Marge went to school. And all the kids used to come and look through railings when horses went by. I was like a king, you know. But that was my school days.
And what age were you at this point walking the horses?
I'd be 11 or 12. The next brother to me, Raymond, 2 years, he had asthma, or so he said, and he was a lazy devil. I used to have to look after him as well, and he were hanging on, but the other brother was Jack, and he was 4 years younger than me. Now, both these fellas served in the army as well as me. Both were in national service, British Army. One served with the East Yorks, and the other one served with, what was Raymond? He was in the catering, not the catering corps, was it? Anyway, he served as well, but it was national service after the war. Raymond went in 1944, conscripted. Then we had a sister, one and only, spoilt to death. She 2 years. Then another brother, there was intermittent, not right sure how where they came along. Would you believe I don't know their birthdays? My dad was, he was a cavalryman. He was mechanically minded and a driver. Same as the whole family, as a matter of fact. But they changed my dad's regiment to armoured, and they gave him Crusader and Cromwell tanks. And they shipped him from Palestine to Alexandria, and he joined the, I think it was Auchinleck's lot then, but he had to learn to drive these things when they were dropped off the ship. And there were a lot of them that never even been behind a wheel. I mean, driving, and those were his things. And they changed that whole regiment into tank crews, and they'd all been with horses. And this is my dad talking, telling me about this. Anyway, he was good at doing the instructing and things like this. So after the Alamein, 1941 or 42 or something like that, I think it was, they shipped him back home, and he was stationed at Barnet Castle, training tank crews on American stuff. He was good at what he did, and he finished up with what they call staff sergeant, a warrant officer. He finished up, so he did all right with the army. And mainly he was shipped because he had a large family, but he was, anyway, I left school at 13 because the war, this was 1939, there was a big move in the UK for producing food and other things. And if you was a farm lad and you got a job, you could leave school. And of course, a lot of us just lined up and said, oh, we can leave school, all right, you know. And so we left school after, was it Otley or Knaresborough? At Knaresborough, which is a market town, on a Wednesday, they had what they call hirings. In Michaelmas time, they had hirings. Now, hirings were from the old slave days, really. These hirings, you lined up, boys and girls, and lined up in the market, and then the farmers came along and said, right, I'll give you eight shilling a year, or whatever it was. Don't give you it, give your carer it. Now, Charles Henry was, as I say, my surrogate farmer, and that's how I came back into farming. And they put me with three brothers Foster, and they were the idlest men. Anyway, and I got fed up of being knocked around from pillar to post, and I deserted them. Now, you weren't sort of allowed to do that, but I did. And I finished up. I always worked with horses, and I worked for snigging timber. Now, if you want to know what snigging timber means, I was snigging timber, and I had a very sad experience. They were knocking pit props. Land Army girls were sawing them into pit props. So you pull them down, and in what they call windrows, and I had two horses in tandem, and this black bloody thing of ginger peg. And the chainman hung on to the logs that should be felled, and I had to take the horses out. Now, what they used to do was go right across the top of what all the branches which had been lopped off in windrows. It used to go through because it was a short cut. And of course, the horses, as soon as they felt the way they wanted to go, I was a bit careless. And I used to let them hang on to the bridle, swing my legs off the floor, and say, clear up. And it was go like the wind. And I came into the clearing, and there's two girls sawing these timbers in their seat. And as I came through, the bole of the tree, or trees, hit this stump. And when it hit this stump, it acted like a whip. It went shook and broke this lass's legs. Both legs went side across. I left that job. I just couldn't. I cried because they said, oh, you know, these things happen, but no, not really. So I give it away. Took the horses back to Billy Eyre and said he'll have to find somebody else, Bill, because he was on a contract, you see, and both horses belonged to him. So anyway, I got a job and I went on the railway. And I went on the railway as a cleaner. The war was going on then. And I worked in a local place called Starbeck, and the largest city and the largest railway place was York. But I started off firing. I never did any cleaning. That's what you was employed as a cleaner. Never did any cleaning because labour was short, you know. There was women doing, although I never saw women do any firing. They sent me on the local shunter that shunted the trucks around in the goods yard, and I learnt how to fire the things and put water in the boiler and general what a railway fireman does. And eventually they took me off that and put me on the local railway, Leeds Harrogate, going round on the commuter trains, what you call them in this day. And I got fed up with that. And one summer's night, the four lads, we sat on the steps of my mother's front door, and we were talking, and they were winning in the Western Desert. We knew they were winning, and of course, in those days, you talked about war, you know, lads. And we talked about war, and Chuck Hardesty, a little bit older than me, but he said, if we don't get into the forces very shortly, we'll miss out, you know. I said, what do you mean? Oh, well, we'll miss out, you know. Everybody sort of said, yeah, right, okay. This is where it comes to a story which is rather interesting. Chuck and I went to Leeds to the recruiting office. We both got into the Marines. I got in as a drummer. Chuck got in, and we were thinking that we would remain together. But no, Chuck was taken. He was sent to Portsmouth, and I went to Plymouth. Now, Plymouth was the land training part of the Marines. It's part of the Navy, is the Royal Marines. They have this land contingent, which nowadays is all commando. And I went into what they call MNBD01, which is Marine Battalion 01. I can show you a photograph of it if you want. I never saw Chuck again until just before the war finished. But that's another part of the story. But we had a lad with us, Ken Loftus, good mate, a little bit older than me. Ken says, no, he said, I'm not going in until they call me. I trained land service, all the thing. Also, in the Marines, you've got to learn how to sail a boat, row a boat and all that sort of thing as well. So my training, for a start, was never a drummer. I never saw a drummer. So I went from there and I joined Marine Battalion number 1. There was 2 battalions of Marines, land service, which they changed into commando. All I did was give you a green beret. I said, you're the commando. Makes me laugh. But anyway, now it does. As I say, I never saw Chuck. Chuck went on to the big ships. He served on the aircraft carriers. Which one? Avengers, I think he was on one. But that's part of the story. Now, the story, I joined. But we went go through all the training. Now, I could sing a bit, right? And every time I used to be singing my heart out, sing all the time. I was singing all sorts of sentimental songs and such as that. I've had the whole basher crying when I was singing some of their songs. And I was at Exeter, Limston, and they sent me from there to Deal, School of Music. Now, when I got to School of Music, I had to go to the band room. And that could be another story, really. But I went to the band room saying, what the hell am I doing here, you know? And I had to sing. And then we had this, what they call Sod's Opera thing they did. And I was in singing in front of the choir, the Marine choir, which we formed. We did this finale on stage, and we all lined up and did the singing. But then the lights went up when we finished, and there's King George VI, his lady love, his queen, and the present day queen and her sister sat in the front row of the Globe Theatre, Deal School of Music. Oh, you know, KG. And I always remember that, it stuck in my mind. But then they said to me, you're going on draft. I said, oh, fair enough. Well, we'd like you to volunteer. Said, no. For the band. I said, no. Let me get back to my unit. And by this time, I was a landing craft driver. And I was on a boat in, what the hell do they call it, Burselton. And I joined, we was crew of 4. I was in the engine room, Shorty O'Royd, coxswain, and the first one we had was LCA, which was a plywood landing craft assault. It had two Ford V8 Thornycroft conversions, marine conversions. And you sat between two engines, and you had the bell bell pulling from here, and it said slow ahead, so on. You had the two throttles here, you see. Carried 30 men. But I trained for so long on them, and then was transferred from there to LCMs, which was Landing Craft Mechanical, which carried a lot more stuff, and it was all steel. And I thought, this is beaut. If small arms, we might be get by, but plywood, I didn't like plywood. And that's what it was, plywood, you know. And I finished up on LCM, Landing Craft Mechanical, they call it. We're getting now towards D-Day. So we were stuck in Burslem Wood under netting. Our jury didn't know about the preparation for D-Day, I don't know, because there were hundreds of boats. And we lived on them. On the Sunday night, we moved out to Sands End, which is Isle of Wight, and we stood off there for a while. Then we got the signal. Well, you've got to also remember that these boats didn't have radios. The communication was all done by lights and Morse. Even walkie-talkies, you might find them amongst some of the passengers. So he went by lights. And we were given the go early Monday morning, would be. And we set off. And we followed a corvette, which had signals. And so we formed up behind this corvette. And the seas were so rough that we were turned back. And we went back into a place called Shoal Haven. We had more seasickness than you could poke a stick at. Everybody was sick, including the crew. Anyway, the following Monday night, or Monday afternoon, we set up, and we assembled again at the Needles, and then we had to follow this corvette again. And the corvette had blue light on it, on the tail, and the coxswain lined up with that and stayed like that. And the idea was this: if you broke down, they would tow you, but we never did, we just followed. But that was the most frightening time of my D-Day experience. The corvettes were up there one time, next minute they were down there, and up there and down there. Every man Jack was seasick, including the crew. That was me. And the soldiers on board, they were, they were all glad to get off, to be honest with you. And we eventually got there, and we stood on the horizon, and we looked, and it had already started, and the big ships were firing. They had the Rodney, Roberts, and a Polish cruiser. But the ships, I'd never seen so many ships in all my life. We did the first trip to the beach on Leon Samoa, and we were unloading ammunition, which we carried ammunition. We unloaded that, and I went back and picked some more up from one of the boats hanging around. You go around in circles like that, and each time they would call you in, and then the beachmaster would tell you on the beach, and the fella on the gangway of the ship that was loading, he would tell you which beach. Mm-hmm. Now, this is all Brits, not American, this is all Brits. They were organised in that respect. And they would tell you what particular light or where you got to land. I landed, and the craft itself was damaged, it tipped. I found myself in water, quite a few others. And I've even swum in 18 inches of water.
18 inches?
Of water. The shorty all right says, "Get up, you silly devil, get on." I had to get onto my feet. I got out of that frightened. I was really frightened. Eventually, they pulled us out of there, Landing Craft crews, to assemble for going into Walcheren Island. That was a disaster as far as Marines were concerned, but I didn't get there. Because I could sing, they transferred me to Plymouth again, sent me on leave. And in some way, I finished up at the place called Gurrock. I got on board a ship and I went to Ireland. Went across to Larne. And I trained on ducks. And driving a duck. And started with the amphib jeep and driving a duck. I just wonder what some of the drivers today are getting one of them things. You've got to drive, I'll tell you. I got a shock of my life when I got on them. When I was in Larne, we were trained. I was there about a fortnight, I think. But I trained on ducks. When I came back, I went on 7 days' leave, so they said. While I was on leave, I got a draft. A policeman come to my door, my mother's door, with a note to say, I've got to report to Gurrock, to RRTO regulation. And when I got there again, I'd been before, and we got on a boat, a landing craft ship, and came out to Bombay through the Mediterranean. There was an incident maybe of interest with D-Day. We were sat on the beach and it was getting towards evening time. Things were slowing down and this ME-109 came in on the right of the American part of it, and he came down and he would be about 50 foot above the deck firing his machine guns, strafing the beach. And I could see the fella that was jockeying it, the pilot. And every man and his dog were having a go at that thing. And he finished up to Le Havre and he crashed. I always remember that. What a either brave man or a bloody idiot. But that's what he did. And I came across quite a few Germans like that. Went over the top, but that's what he did. And he actually strafed things, but when he got, this is how the good Lord looked after me and a few others round about me. When he got past, he just got past the end of a row of boat, and it is down at about 50, and he ran out of ammo, must have, because our part of the beach, he never got a shot. He was firing cannon. Anyway, I went out to the Far East, we didn't have any boats with us. We had to come to Australia, to Anderson in the Swan River, to pick up the landing craft, things like that. That's when I first came to Australia.
So what year was that,
Arthur? 1944. We came through the Suez. We were in convoy. That's where I saw the Ramillies, Gunlunder. They're coming through the Bay of Biscay in convoy, and she was really rough. And the Ramillies, which was one of the escort ships, was a battle cruiser, but all you could see of it was what they call a top hamper. The seas sort of went like that, and the boat went through it like that. I've never seen one. It just looked as if it was going to dive in each time. And that's nothing, says the so-called lads, you know. And then we went to Bombay, I went to Cheetla Camp, I was a driver. I had to pass a test for driving during the day and driving at night to get an Indian license. One of the reasons was because they used to sleep with the feet in the roadway and the curbstone as a pillow. That's what they did, the natives of the place, in Bombay. And you couldn't shift a cow, and you couldn't move a cow. If you came across a cow across the road, and you got out to shift it, there's people everywhere over there. It's not like Australia, there's people everywhere. And if you got out to move the cow, you were warned, don't move the cow, you'll cause a riot. And really, well, did that. I was also in Bombay when the ammunition ship blew up, and that was another big tragedy. Didn't have anything to do with it, we were just there. Then I went down.
What do you remember about that incident, about the ammunition ship?
I remember the explosion. I heard it. We were in Cheetla Camp, and a lot of the lads had already been to, in explosions and things going off. So we sort of ignored it, you know. But we didn't really know until all the emergency service, it was chaotic, was Bombay, because immediately the natives, as they say, wanted to get at the people who were injured. It killed a lot of people. But we were kept out of the way. We said, keep out of the way. We couldn't sort of join in, help or anything like that. Just get out of the way. Because they were frightened to death. But we were all armed. Well, I drove down from Cheetla Camp, and all I did was sort of sticky beaking what was going up. I never got anywhere near the docks because they wouldn't let us go there. Mm-hmm. I know it was devastating. There was a hell of a lot. It was devastating, wasn't it? And Bombay was never the same after. Finished up in North Burma, and then I went down to, we went to Ceylon, and we were assembling in China Bay, Trincomalee, landing craft. Operation, something like that. But I was in what they call combined service, you know, combined operation, Southeast Asia. And pretty similar to Operation Overlord, really, because it was just assembling and training landing craft at China Bay, which is Trincomalee. That's where I met Chuck Hardesty. Chuck, we used to, the Marines particularly, had to fend for themselves. We were supposed to be supplied by the Navy, but we had to rely on the Army, and the Army used to frown on us for certain things, so we used to have to pinch if you wanted to survive. It sounds daft, I know, but it's right. This business with the, any of the bootnecks will tell you, look, a Marine's the biggest scrounger out. And you had to be. And I've got a few funny instances with that scrounging. The officers, this were in Trinco, officers were going to have a party. And I had to go down to the bakery in the docks. And I'm driving out of the docks, going back to Camp 39. And I see this little matlo on the side of the road. Hey, do you want a lift? Aye. So he gets in. And immediately he got in there and said, hey, we were great mates, because we were in the same class at school. Hard to believe, isn't it? So that was one on in the Far East. I can go back again to a similar story. When I was in Normandy, the East Yorks went back through us, from off the beach, went through us. I was going up the road to Bayeux from the beach. 48 Commando had just been through, and they were going to Port Besson. But one of the fellas shouted at me and said, hey, come and look at this house. And I walked across the road, and there's an immediate grave. You know, they used to, the dead buried them immediately, particularly when you were in, when you were going foreign, didn't like you to be observing the lads in front. And it's a grave. And that grave had a cross. It had the same name, Arthur E. Parker. And this, but the regimental number was POX 11, but it wasn't 283, but it was something very, very close. And his date of birth was 7th of 1st, 26. But you see, they take it off the dog tags.
How did you feel?
I don't really know, because most of that particular time that I was there, I was in a bloody daze. I got so frightened in the first incident, I sometimes didn't know where I was. I really was frightened, like a lot of, there were a lot more than me that were frightened. And it was, you just, this is where training came in. If we hadn't been trained for what we did, we wouldn't have done it. You really wouldn't. The first time I came under fire, I dived for a ditch and tried to dig a hole in it with my hands. There was two of us. I tried to beat him to it. It didn't really. And what it was not, they weren't even firing at us. It was a buffer's gun that was just over the top. And this RAF bloke let off a couple of rounds over there. What the hell are we firing at? I don't know, because there were out in front of him that I know of. And bang, bang, bang. And me and a fella called Harry Boston were trying to dig a bloody hole in the ditch where we were to But the sequel to also that interesting story is, earlier on I told you about Kenny Loftus waiting to be conscripted. Well, he did, and he finished up in the East Yorks. Now, the East Yorks went through us. The East Yorks went through us. And I knew he was in the East Yorks. I saw this sergeant. I said, have you got a Yorkshire lad there, Ken Loftus? Oh, aye, he says, he's up. Anyway, they were coming back out. And I was at the crossroads, and I saw this sergeant again. I said, where's Ken then? He says, oh, I'm sorry. He says, but he bought it. He's gone. He sort of took the farm. And what he'd done, it crossed over a stile, and the stile were booby-trapped. It blew him to smithereens. That was Ken. Just shows you, doesn't it, what life's like. He said, no, I'm not. If he'd have joined up with us, he could have still maybe survived. But I don't think so. I always think your number's on it. And the other terrifying thing, in Normandy particular, and I also experienced it, when these big ships fire, the shells, they're huge. I don't know if you've ever seen them, but they weigh a ton. Big things, about that in diameter, about that in length. And when they go, you can hear them making a right bloody din. And when they let a broadside go, it's shocking. You can hear these things before you hear the bang. Go right over the top of landing craft. They're good, man, yeah? They hit what they want to do, particularly on the Royal Navy. They were marvellous bloody gunners.
Is that very vivid in your mind, that sound?
Oh, yeah. Still is. I can hear it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But you know it's going over the top. That's the main thing about it. The most worrying thing was booby traps. Jerry had a hell of a job with booby traps. A lot of stuff he did. We went into Leon-sur-Mer. Leon-sur-Mer was a little village. Arromanches, Leon-sur-Mer. We went into there, two or three days after we were back. We used to take the ammunition for them when we landed. We also took the ammo with us. And when we landed, we unloaded it and put it on 1,500 weights or anything, or carried it wherever it had to go. And keep the fellows at the front supplied. I was never at the front, only apart from when we landed. But when it came to what they call nowadays called combat, I was an ammunition carrier, and that was all you could say, and a landing craft driver. I fired a rifle now and again because I had to, but normally all I did was work a boat, you follow me? When people turn around to me and say, oh, I was a combat soldier, I said, all right, well, what's the difference? There's not a lot of difference, not really, because it's all the same when you're at war, believe me. Even the lowly cooks, as we call them. While I was in Colombo, I was the duty driver to take the shifts, the nurses, from their barracks to work in the hospital. So I'd drive up there with a three-tonner Chevrolet, American thing, and these things had a machine gun ring round, a Bren ring round in the cab. Mm-hmm. So there's Brian and I, and we both get in, because you always had to have tours, you just couldn't go on your own, not allowed. And all the nurses in the back, bloody chitter-chitter and all that. And I said, right, up in here, I'm going to hop out. So he hops me out. He wasn't a driver. I let him steer it, you see. And we're going down the golf course, and I get out, go through the machine gun ring, pull the curtain outside, and all these nasty lassies were screaming, because, where's the driver, where's the driver? We only did it once. There was reports going all over the place. And of course, as far as we were concerned, it was quite safe, but according to, I got 7 days for it. 7 days, BC. Yeah. No, that was plain jokes, you know. The fella called McGlashan. We're still on the war stories. This McGlashan, he was a captain, Royal Marines. And we were in a camp, and this is after the war. we'd all sort of ready to go, and we were into Kurungala. What we were doing was a Japanese prisoner, we were guarding the Japanese prisoners of war, and they were the court, Southeast Asian court, was in a place called Kandy. Kandy's about 5 miles from Kurungala. So we used to take the prisoners to the courtroom. All I was a driver, but as they take them. But Miss McGlashan came to me one night and said, "I want the truck." So I said, "Right, though. Where are we going, sir?" "We're going down to the market." So I go down and says, "Stop here." Next minute, these fellas come out with these bloody blankets out at back of this truck and take them in. These blankets were destined for the Japanese comfort. He was turning them into a profit. Anyway, he got caught and he got cashiered. There were three of us into it. I got 7 days because I didn't have a work ticket. Should have had a work ticket, but I didn't have one. Take notice of Mac. It was rugby union blue, as they call it. Yeah, I can go on for hours with that fella. Well, life afterwards, I had to go back on the railway because it reserved occupation. So I went back on the railway and I was immediately, while I'd been away at war, promotion went on and it was dead man's shoes in the railway and you went up in what they call links. So when I got back, I had about a hell of a lot of seniority ahead of the ones that stayed back working. So the first morning I went, they reported to the control, and I got my cap and my jacket and all that, reported to the driver, and we went onto the table, and this big engine, a Green Arrow, which is very similar to your Flying Scotsman, the Green Arrow being A1 and the other one's A3. I looked up at this thing and I thought, it's as high as, footplate. I looked at this thing, the only thing I'd fired before then was a little shunt. And I said, you'll be all right. So I get on board and I did very well. I did all right. I could work it quite easy and no worries. It's hard work. But I could fire an engine, I could even drive one. Not that you were allowed to drive it, but the driver would give you a break and he'd do a fire and you could do the driving sort of thing. You work together. And I was on there and around about 1949, I got fed up, I was married. I married this little lady here. We've been married 70, how many years?
73.
74.
How did you two meet?
Well, I just...
it was a blind date sort of thing.
Knaresborough had it was well known for what they call the bunny run, was Knaresborough. The town hall was the dance hall, and all the couples used to gather there if you were looking after a lady. Anyway, on the Sunday afternoon, Pauline's birthday, Marge came down the steps to meet Frank Bradley and me. We didn't know one another.
Pauline knew Frank.
Didn't know me. I always remember as they're coming down the steps, Frank Bradley said, "The little lad's mine." I said, "No, it didn't." Because Pauline was about a head taller than Marge at that time. I said, "No." Anyway, when she came down the stairs, Castle, 1066, Castle steps. They came down there and we introduced and said, "We go for a walk." And we went for a walk. And that was it.
We spent most of our days at Knaresborough dancing, didn't we?
But we danced about 3 or 4 times a week. Any minute you got, we'd go dancing, apart from when the lad was born. But even then, we'd go dancing if we'd get a babysitter. But
cycle there, all the week, snow and rain, back, didn't we?
Oh, yeah, particularly 19... That was 1947, wasn't it, when we first met? And anyway, that's when we met. And I was on the railway, 1950, I think it was. But it was getting a little bit, bland, nothing. And again, we were talking, me and another fireman, I said, oh, I'm fed up with this. Because your shifts were iddly-piddly. You could start at 1 o'clock and the following day you'd be starting at 2. And then you'd be finishing it. And we were all up and
so just no routine?
No. Oh. Until you got in what they call the big link, and that is in York particularly, your shifts were anywhere. I mean, I go to work in Starbeck, and I was in what they call the spare link. And I go to work, and the controller says, here, get on the bus, go to York, and you pick up so-so. So I go to York, and next minute, I'd be firing an engine going up towards Newcastle. And then I'd have to come back passenger, see, because the fireman on the proper fireman would be taken sick or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's what sort of thing used to happen quite often. You would, go to York, do blah, blah, blah. It was really iddly-piddly. Marge didn't know where I was, what time I went to work, or, you know, anything. So anyway, we decided, me and Tommy, we'd apply for the fire brigade. It might be something worthwhile there. So we applied for the fire brigade, and we got in, and that was my career.
He was a fireman when he came out here.
I was a fireman out here. 12 years in UK, and what did I have, 16 years in Queensland, 10 years in Woomera. I was in Woomera 10 years, on the emergency service. We had some fun there, didn't we ever? We had Test Shop 2, which was Black Arrow, and it got on fire, used to use a lot of ether, hell of a lot of ether, for cleaning rocket parts. One of the cleaning of a lot of the components. Anyway, it was electrical fault in the air conditioner. And because the air conditioner particularly was saturated with ether, she went on fire, and it was real fire. Test Shop 2. There's supposedly, the crew before us were supposedly got it out in the false roof in Test Shop 2, but they didn't, it reoccurred. So we went into the false roof in the cock roof where the air conditioner trunking was, mm-hmm. and it was shooting out blue flames. And they put the water on, and I was getting it down, and the water went off. So we started to sort of edge back because it increased, and all of a sudden it went woof. Me and Harry finished up going down the ladder. It'd be 20 odd foot, 30 foot maybe in the air. Came down the ladder, and of course this thing blew straight out of the top of us, what they call flashback. Once you get water on a job, you're creating steam, you can build up, and if it's in an enclosed space, if you stop, it will blow. So you keep your pressure on as much as you possibly can. And if you think it's going to blow, lash your branch and come out. That's the way we were taught. And on a couple of occasions, it has occurred. I mean, I had 42 years in the fire brigade, and I had all sorts of incidents, nasty incidents in Wales. I had an adventurous life, you know.
Sounds like it's never been a dull moment.
No. Never a dull moment. I've had some fun. One of the funniest things, shall I tell him that? The funniest things that occurred to me. I had a Wonder Wheel when I was into motorbikes and things like that. And I had a Wonder Wheel. That's a push bike with a wheel, powered wheel in the back. It had a 50cc engine. Which was tuned up, and I used to smoke a pipe. I was in uniform, and I smoke a pipe. I get on the bike, and I put the pipe in my top pocket. So away we went, going past Milton Cricket Club. It's a straight road, and we do it about 30 miles an hour on this bike. And somebody was shouting, "Fire! Fire!" Bullshit, because I was in uniform, you see. Anyway, when I got to the front gate, my jacket is on fire. The pipe the pipe had set fire to my jacket, had it, Marty? Oh, dear. I had that to answer for as well. That was funny, wasn't it? Oh, I used to get some funny things. Some nasty things as well. In situations of the desert, when it was in Wumrah, we had a fire, I forget what, Essel, I think it was, near the crossing, railway. And it was set by the railway, was this fire. And we turned out from Wumrah with three appliances. I was in charge. And we get down to the area, and I could see the fire over there. And I thought, how are we going to get there, you know? Working it out. And we stayed there for a while and sort of weighing up, because it's no good dashing in if you don't know what the hell you're doing. So we're working it out. And this fire went straight over the top of us, over three appliances, big ball. Boom. I've never seen it like it before, nor since. Well, I've seen it since, but before I'd never seen it. We didn't get that sort of thing in the UK. So we caught it all right there. And of course the blue bush is full of oil. And when it gets on fire, well, it forms an oil vapour. And of course it bump and it roll, and away it goes. And this ringer turns up on a motorbike, and he had a dog on the pillion, like they all used to have the dogs on the pillion. And he said, "Do you want to put this out?" I said, "Yeah, we do. Where do you reckon we've got to go?" With no water, you know, only in tanks in the machines. Mm-hmm. Like 300, 600 gallon altogether we had. And he says, "Yeah, well, come with me and I'll show you." So I get up back of this bike. We go off in the donga, and I tell you what, this fella could ride a bike. And I was a motorbike man myself, but he could ride a bike, that lad. When we get there, he says, "Right, this gully here, extend it as much as you can, and when you get down there, all you got to do is extend that." And he says, "It'll stop here." A water course. No bloody water, but it was a water course. Mm-hmm. There's no water. That's what we did. And we used sand. And we made a big fire break around it. Of course, the fire went down. Didn't go any further. They did that at Commonwealth Hill. Took bulldozers in and just bulldozed a big track right through.
Mm-hmm. And that just was... to make a break, yeah.
Yeah, but that at Commonwealth Hill. And we were on Commonwealth Hill as well. We were at Commonwealth Hill for a week. And people say, "Oh, there's nothing to burn out there." You're joking.
Wow.
It is, yeah.
So when did you retire from your service in the fire brigade?
Well, I left Wumrah and I got a promotion into Sydney. And I was in what they call a fire cell in Sydney for, what, 2 years?
Yes.
2-3 years. But it was a civvy job, and mainly looking at fire prevention for the armed forces, Navy and Army, at Moorbank and round there and Singleton. Very sort of second class sort of job, you know. It was all right, I got good salary and I had a house supplied and everything. We lived at Villawood next to the, in the same area as the immigration camp.
Okay.
Villawood.
You're 94 years of age. Can you offer any wisdom or advice for the youth of today?
I don't know. I've learned a few lessons. The only thing I can say is that you've got to learn right from wrong. You've got to respect other people until you find otherwise. And just do the best that you can.
Arthur Parker, thank you very much for talking with me today.
You're welcome. I'm exhausted.
You have been listening to the RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.